Okay, so today we're starting Perek Chet, chapter 8. I put at the top of the sheet review questions from chapter 7 because we really raced through that chapter and didn't, I hope that it's still somewhat clear, but we didn't have the time to give it really the attention it deserved. But if you take a look at those five questions and go through those, hopefully that will be some help in ensuring that you remember what we did last week. We talked about Chiram. We talked about, the big thing was the joint presentations of the Beis HaMikdash on the one hand and Shlomo's palace and palace complex on the other. We had the pillars, Yachin Uboaz. And then the big thing that we talked about was at the end, why doesn't he use the supplies that King David set aside for the Beis HaMikdash? And we gave a range of answers. I'm not revisiting that now, although it may come back. It depends how far we get in our discussion of Chapter 8 today. At the top of the sheet, I also gave you an outline of Chapter 8. This is a huge chapter. I mean, it's huge physically, like in terms of just number of verses. When you look at it, we have these opening couple of sentences in which there is a national assembly of dignitaries and apparently the nation as well. We're going to have to talk about that. Followed by them bringing the Aron, the Ark, with the tablets into the Beis HaMikdash, into the temple. That has a remarkable effect, as we'll see. Then God is described as dwelling in the fog, and we'll have to talk about what that means. Shlomo then gives what I called his valedictory address, in which he says, you know, my father wanted to build this. God told him your son would build it. Well, here I am, Dad. I did it. Followed by his extended prayer to God for the Beis HaMikdash. That we're not going to get to this week. He gives a blessing to the nation. And there's a great celebration with sacrifices and so on. So we have a lot going on. Main items I want to treat today are, number one, the role of the Aron, and number two, Shlomo's focus, what he's trying to accomplish here and how it shapes what he does. We're going to see a lot about him and his personality emerge here. In order to introduce this, I wanted to talk about previous sort of inaugurations that go on in Tanakh, inaugurations of, well, you'll see. I put it on your sheet, that opening section there, the Mishkan in Shiloh, and then when David brought the Aron into Ir David. So, first of all, the dedication of the Mishkan in the Midbar, in the wilderness. So I gave you the reference there, figuring and hoping that people will have their Tanakh with them. Shemot chapter 40. This is the very end of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. The Jews were told in the Parshiot of Truma and Tetzaveh what to create for the Mishkan. And then in Vayakel and Pekudei, they actually made all the items for the Mishkan. And then at the end of Pekudei, in chapter 40 of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, we get the actual building of, or construction of, assembly of, the Mishkan. The Mishkan, again, just because I didn't say it, the traveling temple that the Jews use in the wilderness. So we're told that in the first month of the second year, the first day of that month, the first day of Nisan, the Mishkan is set up. And Moshe sets it up, and it describes him putting up all the beams and putting out the tent over the beams so that you have a building. Then you see him place the luchos, the tablets, into the Aron, and the lid, the kaporet, on top of the Aron. He brings the Aron into the Mishkan. And then he puts in the table for the showbread, and he puts in the menorah, and he puts in the golden altar, and he puts up the curtains. He does all of the different assembly stages. He puts in the kiyor, the sink, he sets up the yard. And then we are told, at the end of that, that a great cloud covers the Ohel Moed, the glory of the Ohel Moed here being a term that we're using apparently for the Mishkan. That's its own discussion, is when is it called an Ohel Moed and what exactly Ohel Moed means, but it's not our discussion right now. The glory of God fills this Mishkan, so much so that Moshe is not able to enter because it has this cloud on top of it and God's glory is filling the Mishkan. And then we're told about the cloud and its role in leading the Jews through the wilderness. This is the assembly of the Mishkan, and it is followed by a 7-day ceremony in which, and it's described, it was described in Parshas Tetzaveh, it's described in practice in chapter 8 of Vayikra, Moshe leads the service for each day of this dedication period. There are special karbanos, there are special offerings, there are gifts brought by the Nesi'im, the heads of each tribe, right? That's your initial dedication in the Torah, the dedication of the Mishkan, and theoretically it's a template for what's going to happen thereafter. Clear? Not too fast? Okay. The second dedication, you can blink and it's gone. And that is dedication of the Mishkan in Shiloh. The Jews come into Israel after 40 years. They camp first in Gilgal, right across the Jordan. They are there for a 14-year period. And then they move the Mishkan, this tabernacle, to Shiloh. And it is set up there for, I think I remember it being 369 years. It's a very long period of time that the Mishkan is there in Shiloh. The dedication of the Mishkan takes all of one verse. If you take a look, as I referenced it on your sheet, Joshua chapter 18, sentence 1, no fanfare at all. It simply says, I found it, the entire congregation of the children of Israel gathered to Shiloh, and they set up the Ohel Moed, this tent, there, and the land was conquered before them. That's it. No, big ceremony, no cloud, no nothing. It could be, because that's a statement, that this is meant to be a temporary place. It's, even though it lasts that long, it wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be just a temporary residence. And then it goes to Nov after Shiloh is destroyed. But Nov, you certainly aren't going to get a dedication ceremony. Nov doesn't even have the Aron in it. There's no ark. And then Nov is destroyed by Shaul, and it goes to Giv'on, still without the ark in it. There's no dedication for that either. And then the Aron, which has been residing in a place called Kiryat Ya'arim, is brought by David to Ir David, also known as Tzion, in Yerushalayim. And here I draw your attention to Shmuel Bet, Samuel 2, chapter 6. David is going to try to bring the Aron to Ir David twice, because a tragedy happens the first time. You may be familiar with that story. I'm just flipping to it in my Tanakh here. Chapter 6, sentence 3. Okay, people have it, I hope. Those who are doing this with their screens off, if you want to turn your screens on, any time, if you're eating lunch, it doesn't bother me in the least. I'm not hungry. So if you take a look at chapter 6, sentence 3, they brought the Aron of God on a new wagon, right? Everyone sees that. It comes from the house of Abinadav, which is in Giv'ah. And you have you have Uzzah and Abinadav, who are leading the wagon that is carrying the Aron. And they carry up the Aron, and then the terrible story happens in which it appears that the Aron is about to fall. Uzzah stretches out his hand to the Aron, and and he dies. God strikes Uzzah. And why God strikes Uzzah, he seems to mean well. What is this whole story about? Why does death have to come with the Aron? These are all good questions that we're not going to be talking about right now. But instead, we see that David gets very, very upset, and he says, I can't do this. And he backs off. And the Aron goes to the house of a man by the name of Obed Edom, which is a remarkable name for somebody who's housing the Aron, and a topic for another time. And the Aron stays with Obed Edom for 3 months, and everybody seems to be okay. And so David says, all right, fine, I'm going to try again. I'm going to try to bring the Aron to Ir David. And we're in the same chapter now, still Shmuel Bet, chapter 6, sentence 12. And in sentence 12, we find that David again takes the Aron, the ark, up from the house of Obed Edom, bisimcha, with joy. And you see that as you proceed through the sentences, with every step, they slaughter animals. And David is dancing with all of his energy before God, and he's wearing some kind of a linen tunic. And they're bringing the Aron up, and there is music going on. They're blowing the shofar. And Michal, daughter of Shaul and David's wife, looking out the window, and she is not impressed. She looks at him and says, this is degrading. We'll talk about that. They bring the Aron of God. They put it in the tent where it belongs that David has set up, and David brings more sacrifices. And gives food to the nation. A great big celebration. In Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 15, and I'm not going to have you turn there. You've turned a lot of pages already, and it's only 142. In Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 15, chapter 16, we get more details. We find out that, first of all, the Kohanim are carrying the Aron now. David believes that that was his mistake the first time, having it on a wagon. And that the failure to do so was what killed Uzzah. So David says, now I'm going to have the Kohanim carry the Aron. And like I said, it's this great, big, wonderful celebration. Here you see three different kinds of dedications. The first kind of dedication in the Midbar, in the wilderness, with the Mishkan, was very formal. Right? You have the 7 days of sacrifices. You have the gifts. Each one brings the same gift from the Nesi'im, from the leaders of each tribe. Everybody's assembled. Moshe puts everything up in order. There's no dancing that we can see. There's no singing that we can see. There's no music that we can see. It's just sacrifices. That's what's done. A very formal type of a dedication. Your second one, the Mishkan in Shiloh, is very low-key. There's like nothing going on. The text it acts as though they just said, okay, fine, now we're moving the Mishkan here. Mission accomplished. Next. And then you have bringing the Aron to Ir David, and that is a wild celebration. So wild that Michal is going to make fun of David, and I'm going to come back to that later on, I hope. So the question in my mind, as I approach this chapter, Shlomo has now built the Mishkan. Shlomo has now gotten all the different pieces together. What's he going to do? Which model is he going to go for? Or is he going to create a fourth model? Is he going to do something altogether different? You follow? That's what I want to know here. Questions or comments?
I don't understand what is the problem that he has. The Simcha was very good. David was a musician. We hear all kind of music instruments that he was using and the people around him, which is really beautiful to see. And I don't understand why Brother Michal...
So we're going to come back to Michal. It's a good question. I'm just not ready for it yet. But it's a very good question. What is it that so upsets Michal about what David is doing? So hang on to that question. I think we'll get to it today. If not, it'll be next week, but I think we'll get to it today. So other questions or comments? Or let's launch into the assembly of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, let's go. So take a look now in Malachim Aleph, Perek Chet, Kings 1, Chapter 8, the beginning of the chapter. Okay. So first of all, just I wanted to adjust something that I said last time when we talked about the assembly of the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. Last time round, I quoted Rabbi Yitzchak Levi, who said, based on verses in chapter 9, that it seems that Shlomo waits to dedicate the Beis HaMikdash until his own palace complex is complete, after the full 20 years. And I think that's a good literal read of the sentences. Nonetheless, Abar Benel thinks that that's not correct. Abar Benel quotes you a medrash. He says it's in a psikta, unclear exactly where it is. It suggests that no, Shlomo dedicates it after it is complete. And the problem that he expresses, that this medrash expresses, is that there is some kind of a gap between the completion and the dedication. Meaning, take a look at sentence 1 in chapter 8. Az Yakel Shlomo Azikne Yisrael. Shlomo gathered all the elders of Israel. And it goes on to list the heads of all the families. They all come to Shlomo to bring in the Aron from the city of David, which is Tzion. Vayikalu al HaMelech Shlomo, and they gathered to Shlomo, Kol Ish Yisrael, who are Kol Ish Yisrael, we'll come back to, B'Yerach HaEisanim, in the month of the Eitanim, Bechag, on this festival, Hu HaChodesh HaShvi'i, the seventh month. So they're doing this in the seventh month. That is the month of... What's the seventh month?
Tishrei.
Tishrei, right. Tell me something. When did Shlomo finish building all the things he needed for the Beis HaMikdash? When did he finish the structure? We know, because we read it. We even talked about the meaning of the name of the month. The name is associated with a flood.
Cheshvan.
Right. It was Cheshvan, the month of Bul, right? Was what we talked about. So the question that the Medrash asks, that Abarbanel brings, is what were they doing for 11 months? Right? You finished it in Cheshvan, and then you dedicated it the following Tishrei. What happened for 11 months? Look at this Medrash. It was a very fascinating Medrash. Moish, you're going to love this Medrash. This is really something. And then he's going to bring his own idea, which is different from what the Medrash says. Source number one. Ugvar Gishu Chazal b'psikta rabti. He quotes this as being in psikta rabti, but in the parentheses they tell you it's in the Yalkut. Doesn't affect us. Im hayasha b'chodesh bul shumar cheshvan nishlama melechas habayis. If it was in Cheshvan, the month called Bul, that they completed the building of the house, lama lahu v'ha'aron miyad ki mad yerach ha'isinim shu chodesh tishrei. Why did you wait until Tishrei to bring it in? It doesn't say anything about what happened in the intervening 11 months. So they said the following. The building is complete for 11 months. And all Israel were hesitating. Legamgam is a word that we use for like stammering. They were like, I don't know about this. They remember the scandal. Remember we talked about in the beginning of Malachim how there were people who may have supported Adoniyahu because of the scandal of David and Bathsheba? Well, this Medrash resurrects it and says there are people sitting there thinking, how in the world can the child born from David and Bathsheba build the Beis HaMikdash? Can't be. So what does Hashem do? Bakadosh Baruch Hu chashav la'akev simchas beis hamikdash ad chodesh nolad b'avram shu yerach ha'esanim. Hashem says, I want to delay the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash until the month when Avraham was born. Yerach ha'etanim. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Daf Yud Aleph tells us that Avraham is born in Tishrei. And similarly, the Medrash says, the Mishkan is dedicated on the first of Nisan. We just read that before. But we are taught that it was actually completed on the 25th of Kislev. So again, you have a gap. Right? You're going through Tevet, Shvat, Adar, until the first of Nisan. Why did you wait then? The answer was, L'fisha Kadosh Baruch Hu Ikev Simchas HaKamas HaMishkan Ad HaChodesh Shenolad Bo Yitzchak. Hashem wanted to wait until the month when Yitzchak was born for the Mishkan. So he's waiting for Avraham. That's what the Medrash says. Zeu kulo lefi drash. He says, that's the Medrash. And then he says, I'll give you a different answer. Kfiya pshat. Pshat, simple answer. He says, Hutzrichu osam ayurav chadashim la'kil Shlomo as kol Yisrael. Shlomo's gathering everybody. All the leaders have to show up. That takes time. You can't just send out an evite and say, hey, let's get together. You have to plan it properly. You have to send messengers. You have to pick a time that's going to work for everybody. That's not straightforward. You can't do it when parliament is on break, that's for sure. So it ends up waiting until Sukkot. V'sheyia achrei asifas hatfuos m'nei simchasam. It has to be after the harvest. It'll be a time of great joy. U'latakena inyanim atzrichim la'osa simcha v'tzahala kefi ha'am harav sheikahel shama. In order to get everything in order for that joy and celebration for the great nation that would gather there. So, just in terms of when this is happening, according to what we saw last week, Rabbi Yitzhak Levi, it's happening after the whole 20 years of construction. According to the Medrash that Abarbanel brings here, no, it was right after the Beis HaMikdash was complete, except that it wasn't right away, he waited almost a year. Either because people are objecting and God says, I want a good sign for them, so I'm going to do it when Avram was born. Or, a practical step, you're bringing everybody in, do it at the time of the harvest, that's the way to do it. Clear? I find that Medrash about the people protesting fascinating. Right? The idea that that the people were upset. I think there's a lot to be said about that, which unfortunately we're not going to say right now. We're not going to go into it right now, but I just wanted you to see that. That's number one. Number two, he invites all the elders and leaders to bring the Aron. So Abarbanel writes that this wasn't a requirement of the event, that you have to have all the elders there. But it's an honor of the Aron. That's his view. However, the Malbim says, no, you needed to have the leaders there. You need a Sanhedrin. Consecration of space requires a Sanhedrin. He points you to source number two, the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which says, anytime you want to add to the city, meaning Jerusalem, or to the Azarot, the spaces in the Beis HaMikdash, you need a Beit Din of 71. We discussed this when we learned Nehemiah. And he had to consecrate space. So that's why Shlomo brings them, he says. But it also says in sentence two that all Ish Yisrael arrive. It's not clear who the Ish Yisrael are. Professor Keel in the Dot Mikra thinks it means the leaders. Ish is often a reference to a leader. I find that difficult, though, because sentence three is going to say all the Zakenim came, all the elders came. If you meant the elders here, you should have said it here. So I would go with the view that Abarbanel gives, which is Kol Ish Yisrael means the Jews in general. I hope it means the women also, but I don't actually know. But they came, even though they weren't invited, in honor of Hashem. Also, as Malbim says, in honor of Shlomo. So they show up, and it's in this Yerach HaEitanim. We have already noted that we saw 2 months, which were associated with the building of the Beis HaMikdash that got Hebrew names. We had Ziv, right, the second month, Iyar, and we had Bul, which is Cheshvan. So here we get Eitanim, which is Tishrei. The word Eitan means strong. Steadfast. That's the idea. Radak references for you a pasuk in Micha. Micha chapter 6, sentence 2. V'ha'etanim mos de'aretz. The etanim who are the foundations of the land. But the word etan is a word you already find in Chumash. Nachal etan. It means something that is strong, that is steadfast, that has power, that is enduring. So they take that month and label it Eitanim. Why should that month be called Eitanim? So if you look at source number 3 on the sheet, I didn't bring all the sources, I just brought you the list of what they say. Radak says it's called Eitanim, strength, because it's the when you bring the produce into the home and therefore you feel strong. Okay. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us it's because of the strength of the patriarchs who are born then, Avraham and Yaakov, or the festivals, the chagim with their mitzvos, that are celebrated at that time. And Ralbag says it's the time of celebrations which lead people to shleimut, which lead people to improvement in their religious character. Okay, so that's just setting the stage. We know when this happens. We know who's there. But now let's see what happens. Questions or comments until now? No, we're good? Okay? All right. Then let's move. We are now installing the Aron. And I really, really like what Malbim says here. If you take a look at source number 4 on the sheet, we're going to see that when the Aron comes in, a cloud enters, much like what happened with the Mishkan, what we saw already. Take a look at source number 4. In the interest of time, I'm just going to read out my English translation, but you can see the original Hebrew there. the Aaron's relationship with the overall body, which is the sanctuary, the Mikdash, is like the relationship of the soul in the mind of the individual body, the person. In other words, as soul is to body, so is Aaron to Beis HaMikdash. Therefore, like the soul has three elements, what are they? First, it is alone in an upper haven. It dwells on its own, off to, its own realm. Number two, it thinks its thoughts on its own, even as it is locked in the body. It may be attached to the body, but it's doing its own thing. But number three, it sends forth its thoughts to illuminate the darkness of the body and to radiate light from the midst of the darkness and fog to the body's limbs. In other words, the soul is in its spiritual existence. It's not physical. Its operations, if you will, are spiritual. They're not associated with the body. And yet, it connects to the body. It illuminates the body. It brings the body to life. That's what the Aaron is like between the rings of the Kruvim. It is like the soul in its celestial divine haven, meaning the Aaron is in its own area. And that actually fits very well with the Gemara that talks about whether the Aaron takes up space and how space works with the Aaron. But we're not going to go into that. But the Aaron is in its own domain. It is not physical in the sense of being involved. I mean, it's a physical object, but it's not associated with anything else that's going on, except that it fuels everything that goes on. So you bring in the Aaron, and if the battery has been installed, everything lights up. That's the idea. And we see that happening here in our psukim in several ways. Take a look, please, chapter 8, sentence 3. First of all, we're now about to do the dedication. Vayavou kol ziknei Yisrael, all the elders of Israel came. Vayisua kohanim es ha'aron, and the kohanim carried the aron. Vayalu es aron Hashem v'yasol moed ves kol klei hakodesh asher ba'ohel, and they brought in the aron of God. And they also brought the Ohel Moed, the tent from the wilderness. That's going to go into Geniza, into storage. They're not going to use it. They brought in all the holy vessels that had been in the Mishkan. And the Kohanim and the Levium brought those in. And right away we see a difference between the Aron here and what happened when they dedicated the Mishkan. What's the difference between the Aron here and the introduction of the Aron with the Mishkan? The Aron of the Mishkan came in first or last? The Aron of the Mishkan came in first. We read it. It was in the verses in Shemot chapter 40. Exodus.
Okay, yes, so now it depends what is in the Aron.
Well, what's in the Aron we're going to get to. But the Aron then was first. And then afterwards it said they brought in the Shulchan, and they brought in the Menorah, and they brought in the Mizbeach, and all of that. The Aron was first. Here, the Aron comes in last. Everything else has been built. Everything else is in place. All you're bringing in is the Aron, along with the tent and the vessels from the previous Mikdash, from the Mishkan, in other words. The Aron comes in at the end, which highlights its importance. Think about the creation of human beings on day 6 of creation. There are two different ideas that are brought in the Talmud to explain why human beings are created last. One view is that human beings are created last in order to keep us humble. Look, the mosquito was there before you. But the other view that's brought, which I think is the dominant view, is that it's to say God gets everything ready and then brings us in. Everything is for us. In the Beis HaMikdash, everything is for the Aron. Also worth noting here, the Aron is carried by the Kohanim. That's a really interesting thing. Divrei Hayamim, actually, in its version of it, in Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter 5, mentions Levim, but then it also says the Kohanim further along, and we understand, generally speaking, it means the Kohanim of the tribe of Levi. But the reason why this is a problem is, take a look at Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 4, sentence 15. There we are told about who carries what things from the Mishkan, and there we are told specifically that Kehat, from the tribe of Levi, is supposed to carry the Aron, and nobody else. They are the ones who are supposed to be carrying the Aron. They're supposed to carry the Ark. So why is it that the Kohanim are carrying the Aron here? So a few different answers. If you take a look at source number 6 on your sheet, I just gave them to you as a list. First answer, from the Rambam's view, is that really it's always supposed to be the Kohanim. They only had Levim carry it when there weren't enough Kohanim in the early stage. Once there are enough Kohanim, the Kohanim carry it. That's one answer. Ramban, Nachmanides, disagrees, following the Gemara in Sota in source number 7, I brought it for you, which says the Kohanim carried the Aron in three places. When they crossed the Jordan, when they circumnavigated Jericho, they went around the city the 7 times, right, the 7 days, and when they returned the Aron to its place, as happens here. There are a couple of places where they bring the Aron back. But he says, no, there are special occasions when the Kohanim carry it, and this is a special occasion. This is different. Why those occasions? A good discussion. If you go back to the class that we had way, way back, years and years ago on Yehoshua, I discussed it there. And then Rabag gives you a very practical answer, which makes a lot of sense. He says the Aron here is going into the Kodesh Kadashim. You're carrying it into the Holy of Holies. It has to be a Kohen who's going to do that. Levi doesn't get to go into the Holy of Holies. Very practical answer from Ralbag. Very much like him. So the Kohanim are carrying the Aron. The Aron is entering at the end of the process, not the beginning of the process. Well, I'm bringing you this in order to show you how we highlight the importance of the Aron, of this Ark. We still don't know what's in it. Not only that, keep on reading, please. Chapter 8, sentences 6 and 7. I just have to flip back from Bamidbar now. Chapter 8, sentence 6. Sentence 5 just said that Shlomo and all the Jews are with him in front of the Aron. They're sacrificing innumerable animals. And then we're told, the Kohanim bring the Aron of the covenant of God to its place, to the Devir of the house, the Kodesh HaKodashim, the Holy of Holies, beneath the wings of the Kruvim. Remember those new cherubs that Shlomo created? So beneath those new cherubs, because these cherubs are stretching out their wings to the place of the Aron, and they cover and surround the Aron and its poles from above. So we highlight these brand new Kruvim. Remember that we asked the question about why Shlomo created new Kruvim. I brought you a... No, I didn't bring it on here. I thought I brought it on here. Remember, we talked about why. So there was a Radak, which I had not seen before. He comments on the Kruvim here, asking the question of why Shlomo is creating new things. So his answer to it is one of the answers that we brought in the previous chapter, which is that you shouldn't ask questions. He says it's there because of prophecy. Why did Shlomo do it? Because God told him to. That's Radak's answer. But at the time, we gave multiple reasons for these new Kruvim. We suggested it could be because of their grandeur. They're very large. We suggested it could be to reflect the permanence of the new location, right? Rav Bazak's point that these Kruvim stand on the ground. They're not standing on top of the Aron. Or it reflects the new relationship with God that the Jews have. where we brought the Gemara in Bava Basra about them facing each other or facing outward, Reb Chaim Volozhin, the Nefesh HaChayim, we discussed all of that. But what we're doing here is we're highlighting the old Aron and the new Kruvim, validating what Shlomo has done in this new Beis HaMikdash. Another element here, the poles of the Aron are emphasized. If you take a look at chapter 8, sentence 8, we are told, Vayarichu habadim, they extended the poles. Vayirau rashei habadim and akodesh al pnei adavir, they were visible from the sanctuary, from the sanctum, meaning the Kodesh Kadashim, the Holy of Holies, and the face of the Devir, this area that they're in, but they weren't seen outside. And they're there until this very day. What in the world are you talking about? What does that mean? So most commentators explain this to mean the following. The Aron was positioned to be carried with these poles, even though, yes, the Aron carries those who carry it, and Uzzah got in trouble. Nonetheless, the idea is that the Aron is supposed to be positioned as though it's being carried via these poles. So you have two in front, two carriers in front, and two carriers in back, and the pole is on their shoulders. That means that the Aron is going to be positioned in the middle of the poles. Right? You have equal space in front and equal space in back. Now, the poles extend forward, and most commentators explain what that means is they move them forward out of their alignment so that it would all be forward. Ralbag says no. He thinks it says they extended them. That means they actually added to them. They created pole extensions that went forward. But the idea was either way, as Radak explains in source number 8, to demonstrate we're not carrying the Aron anymore. We have now arrived where we belong. The Aron isn't going anywhere. Take a look at source number 8, Radak. They extended them outward, meaning they extended them toward the outside because there was no more need to carry it on their shoulders. And they extended them toward the outside. Why extend them forward? To the point that the ends of the poles were visible before the devir, in front of the space. They're like shoving the curtain a little bit, so that the Kohen Gadol would enter there on Yom Kippur to burn incense between the poles, and he would not turn this way and that. In other words, it's obvious, X marks the spot. This is where you stand in front of the Aron. But the point for us, and the reason why I stress this, is again, we're taking time to emphasize that the Aron is now settled. The Aron is clearly the center of the show. And then we get sentence 10. And that is where the cloud comes in. Chapter 8, sentence 10. When the Kohanim left the Holy of Holies, I'm just reading it out, and I'm just translating it as I go. The cloud filled the house of God. The Kohanim could not serve because of the cloud, just like with Moshe and the Mishkan, because the glory of God filled the house of God. And then we are told, we get this statement from Shlomo, God said he would dwell in the fog, in sentence 12. And he said, I built a home for God, a place for your resting forever. That's what Shlomo says. So, what exactly is this, this cloud here? It's an interesting question. Made stronger by Divrei Hayamim Bet. Take a look at Divrei Hayamim Bet, Chronicles 2, chapter 7, please. Chronicles 2, chapter 7. Sentence 1. This is the record there of what happens when Shlomo brings in the Aron. And it says, when Shlomo finished his prayer, fire came down from the heavens and consumed the sacrifices, and the glory of God filled the house. And the Kohanim could not enter the house of God because the glory of God filled the house of God. And all the Jews, when they saw this fire descend and the glory of God upon the house, they bowed low to the ground, and they praised God, they thanked God, Hodu Hashem Kitov, Kili Olam Chasdo. There's no mention of a cloud at all There's only a mention of fire. It's also a different point in the ceremony, which is its own discussion. But what is this? So Abarbanel has a fascinating idea with ramifications elsewhere in Tanakh. If you take a look at source number 10 on your sheet, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, the English at the top of the next side. I'm just going to read out my English translation from Abarbanel. He says, the desired end in the work of the construction, the manifestation of God's Shekhinah in this house, happened instantly when the Aron was placed in its space. For once the Kohanim put it in the Holy of Holies, immediately when they left the Devir, a pillar of cloud descended and filled the house of God. The honor of God, when it says the honor of God or the glory of God, however you translate it, Kavod Hashem is the Hebrew, is stated specifically regarding the light seen in the cloud, which the text calls fire. Like in Shemot chapter 24, the honor of God resided atop Mount Sinai and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And the appearance of the honor of God was like a fire consuming atop the mountain to the eyes of Bnei Yisrael. The glory of God is a fire that's actually inside the cloud. He says, this shows the honor of God is not the cloud, but it is something resembling fire in its light and radiance, and the cloud is around it concealing it. From this you know that when it says, and the cloud covered it for 6 days, which we just read, right, the honor of God resided atop Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days, it does not refer to the mountain or to Moshe, like the two sages who disputed this issue in Yoma 4b. He says it's not like the views in the Gemara. He doesn't like those views in the Gemara. This is Abarbanel. He can do that. He says, in truth, it refers to the honor that was mentioned. The cloud covered it for 6 days, and it was not visible to Israel all through those days. They could only see the cloud. In other words, go back to the beginning of this paragraph. And the honor of God resided atop Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered the honor of God for 6 days. So what's happening is you have a fire in a cloud. That's what's happening. And he says, the Rambam agrees with this in his Mora Nevuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed. And Ramban agrees with it in his commentary on that verse. And even Ezra wrote about it in the end of the book of Shemot. All of these, the leaders of Israel agreed the honor of God refers to the light and fire in the cloud specifically. He says, that's what you need to know. And he has this whole discussion about why it mentions the fire in Divrei HaYamim, and it mentions the cloud over here. I'm not going into it. I just wanted you to know about this. But the point is that this leads to what Shlomo says next. When he says, God said he would dwell in the fog, in the Arafel in the Hebrew, it means this cloud. God is dwelling in this cloud. You follow? Malbim actually explains the verse differently. Malbim says that that God said he would dwell in the cloud means God said back when the world was emptiness and void and so on that he would dwell in this place. You should pick up a copy of Toronto Torah this Shabbos because the front page article talks about that. It's an article, the issue is dedicated to Yom Yerushalayim and it's all about Yerushalayim. So the front page article is about that Malbim. In any case, the Aron is the big show. You bring in the Aron and you activate the Beis HaMikdash. So Ruchama said before, we don't know what's in the Aron. What is inside the Aron? What's there? Well, it's actually a good question. Go back to sentence 9. It's an odd sentence. The sentence says, Ein ba'aron, rak shnei luchos ha'avanim asher hiniach sham Moshe b'chorev. There is not in the Aron only the two tablets of stone that Moshe put in there in Chorev, the ones that God made a covenant with the Jews, and so on. So commentators debate how to read that. There is not in the Aron only these two tablets. So I didn't want to bog us down with the discussion because, again, we're trying to catch up here with this whole story. But I gave you a list in source number 11 of the different views. Radak says it means that the Aron only contains the whole tablets. That's it. Radak takes the view, there's a debate in the Gemara as to whether there was one Aron or whether there were two Aronot. So Radak takes the view that there are two Aronot. There's another one that goes into storage. And the other one contains the Torah that Moshe wrote, as well as the broken tablets. Which is why, later on, when Chilkiyahu the Kohen Gadol finds a Torah and he's so shocked by it, it's because he found Moshe's Torah and it wasn't in that other Aron where it was stored. That's Radak's view. He takes the view that there are two Aronot. It's Yerushalmi and Shkalim. Ralbag says no. Ralbag says, first of all, Ralbag believes that there's only one Aron, which is also a view in that Yerushalmi. Ramban takes that view as well. And he says, when it says there was not in the Aron, but the tablets, it means that the tablets are the only part of Torah that is in this Aron. However, you also had in it a jar of man. And you also had in it Aaron's staff, because we were told that they were put in the Mishkan. They were there as a preserve. Everybody should remember the miracles that happened. So Rabag says they're in the Aaron too. When it says there's nothing in the Aaron, but it means there's no part of Torah in this Aaron except these things. Bar Minhag does not like that idea, because the Torah doesn't say that the jar and the staff went in the Aron. It just says they were before God. They're not in the Aron. Abarbanel himself says, he follows the view in the Gemara in Bava Basra, Daf Yudalid, that the contents of the Aron are the two sets of tablets. The whole tablets and the broken ones. And you may be familiar with the classic line on this, about whole and broken tablets. Does this sound familiar? The Gemara says, Hizaru bezakein sheshachach talmudo. Be careful with an elder who has forgotten his learning, because the whole tablets and the broken tablets are kept in the Aron. It's an important lesson. So he says they're both in the Aron, and when the text says there's nothing in the Aron but the two tablets, that means including the originals. They're both included in that. Malbim also reads it this way, although he reads the Gemara very interestingly. He reads it, the sentence to be, Ein ba'aron rak shnei luchos avanim. It isn't only the two tablets that are there, there's also something else there. That's the way that he reads it. It's a whole thing with the Gemara, but I'm not going into it right now. But here's the big thing. Why is the Aron such a centerpiece here? We have it at the end, the Kohanim, the Kruvim, the poles, the cloud. Why is the Aron so highlighted? I mean, the first answer is, well, Torchiner, you told us, right? It's because when you bring it in, that's when the sanctity comes in. That's when the cloud comes in. Of course it's going to be highlighted, and that's true. Also, the Aron contains the Luchos, these tablets, whichever set of tablets it has. It's where prophecy emerged for Moshe, it's in the Holy of Holies. Of course it's going to be the focus. Also true. But I want to point to something else that's going to matter. The Aron is the reason there's a Beis HaMikdash at all. Go way back to Shmuel Bet, chapter 7, sentence 2, please. Samuel 2, chapter 7, sentence 2. When David first said, I want to build a Beis HaMikdash, the king said, Vayomer HaMelech al Nasan HaNavi, the king said to the prophet Nasan, Re'ena Anochi Yoshev beBeis HaRazim, I am sitting in this cedar palace. And the Ark of God, the Aron, is behind a curtain. That's not right. So the Aron is what got David going in the first place. Abarbanel notes this. And please keep it in mind, because it's going to matter a great deal. Although I'm losing faith in the idea that we're going to answer it today. Okay, fine. But it's going to be an important idea next week for sure. So questions and comments at this stage? We see the Aron being highlighted. We see all the different aspects of it that are being spelled out. We see that it ushers in the cloud of the glory of Hashem. We get all of that, and it's important for all those reasons and because it's what motivated David in the first place. Well, let's see what comes next. Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14, begins for us Shlomo's valedictory address. The king turned his face, meaning he turns to the nation, and he blesses all of the congregation of Israel, and everybody is standing. And he said, "Blessed be Hashem, the God of Israel, who spoke with his mouth to my father David, and he filled David's hand. He gave him the power, saying, 'Since the day I took my nation Israel out of Egypt, I never chose a city from the entire tribes of Israel to build a house for my name to be there.'" I didn't pick a building. I didn't pick a place. I picked a person. I picked David to be upon my nation Israel. And it was in the heart of my father David, Shlomo says, to build a house in the name of Hashem, God of Israel. He wanted to do it. And Hashem told David, my father, listen, you wanted to build it. It's good that you wanted to build it, but you're not going to build it. Your son who emerges from you, he's going to be the one to build it. And Hashem has fulfilled his word. I arose in place of my father David, I sit on the throne of Israel as God promised, and I have built this house in the name of Hashem, God of Israel, and I put a place there for the Aron, which has the covenant that Hashem made with our ancestors when he took them out of Egypt. Mission accomplished, Shlomo says. I did it. Okay. First of all, did you notice it said that he gave a bracha, he gave a blessing? What was the blessing? What was the blessing? What blessing did he give the Jews? So the truth of the matter is, the text doesn't seem to say. And most of the commentators just kind of shrug. But that's okay. Because back in the Mishkan, it also said that Moshe gave a blessing to the people. Go back to Shemot chapter 39, sentence 43. Right? The very end. Well, not the very end. The almost very end. Moshe saw all of the work, everything they had done, and they had done exactly what God said to do, so they did. Vayivarech osam Moshe, and Moshe blessed them. But it doesn't say what the blessing was. In Vayikra chapter 9, sentence 22, we are told that Aaron blessed the people. And it doesn't say what blessing he gave them. There, we assume it's Berachas Kohanim, right? Yivarecha Ya'er Yisa, because we learn laws of Berachas Kohanim from that verse. The text doesn't say, though. What about Moshe's bracha? I brought you a medrash in source number 12. I'm going to read out my English translation. It asks, with what blessing did he bless them? What was the bracha? And their answer is, he said, V'hinoam Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu, I'm sorry, he said, Yihiratzon Shetishra Shechina B'maseh Yedeichem. May it be God's will that the Shekhinah should be manifest on your handiwork. And they responded with a line that makes it into Tehillim. May the pleasantness of Hashem our God be upon us, establish our handiwork upon us, and establish our handiwork. And the Medrash continues from there. But it's not in the text. It's a nice bracha. It's not in the text. So it shouldn't be shocking that the text doesn't tell us what Shlomo's bracha was. And so, like I said, most of the commentators just say, I don't know. He will give another bracha at the end of the chapter, and there we will find the text. But Abarbanel says no. Abarbanel says the bracha of Shlomo is the prayer he is about to recite. Take a look at source number 13. He said, and it appears to me the blessing here is the prayer he prayed to God, which we haven't yet read. For his eyes to be opened toward this house, to hear the prayer of those who pray and plead before him in that house. For this was a great blessing for the nation of Israel. So his prayer, when he says, God, please listen to their prayers in this house, that was a blessing for the people. And then he says, with characteristic Abarbanel, kind of just like straight man type of thing, and perhaps when the king turned his face to the nation, he blessed them with a customary blessing, like, I don't know, Hashem Imachem, right, from Rus. Hashem be with you, or Shalom Aleichem. And so it says that he blessed the nation, and then he began his prayer. It was some greeting. He said Shalom Aleichem, and then he started talking. Okay. And then he gives this speech. The speech in which he says, Hashem never asked for a house. Hashem chose a person. The person wanted to build a house, and Hashem liked that idea. And Hashem said that David's son would sit on the throne and do it, and that's what I have done. If you take a look at source number, no, I didn't bring it here. Sorry, I didn't bring it. But Abarbanel says this is an introduction to his prayer. It's a way to express that everything he has done to this point has been at Hashem's command. I didn't make this up. Got it? So we're not going to get to the full idea that I'm about to launch into. But I want to start the idea anyway. I find the fact that Shlomo invokes David here fascinating. Because it points to a big question which underlies the entire enterprise of building the Beis HaMikdash and everything we've learned all year long. We're in week 30 of our shiurim. So you've been here for 29 hours and almost 30 hours, 3 minutes short. What's the relationship between David and Shlomo? What is this relationship? We talked about it a little bit in the beginning of the year. But I want to understand this. You know, Shlomo emphasizes bringing in the Aron, but he doesn't do it the way David did it. When David brought the Aron to Ir David, it was with music, it was with wild dancing. You know, yes, they're happy here also. We'll see that very clearly. They're happy here, and they're certainly well fed, but it's much more sedate. It's much more carbon focused. And my question is why? Why doesn't he do it the way David did it? You follow? Why doesn't this look like what we read an hour ago? What would you say? Uh-oh.
Oh.
Yeah, Alina.
Not everyone, including David's wife, thought he did it in the proper way. So maybe Shlomo thought, you know, maybe it's not appropriate.
Is Shlomo passing judgment on what his father did? It's a very interesting possibility. I wouldn't quite go that far as to say passing judgment. I mean, those are my words, not yours. But there's something going on for sure. So we have another minute, so I'm going to start on the idea. We saw very early in Malachim that Shlomo was charged with emulating his father. Shlomo gets the throne because Hashem told his father that his heir would have it. And specifically that it would be Shlomo, son of Bathsheba. David was the one who thwarted Adoniyahu's coup, and he put Shlomo on the throne. As recorded in Divrei Hayamim, you will recall, we talked a lot about this, David told the nation, Shlomo's going to build the Beis HaMikdash. He gave Shlomo the materials. He gave Shlomo the design. He set up what the Kohanim are going to do and what the Levim are going to do, the whole bit. In his last speech to Shlomo, David told him, I want you to keep the mitzvos. I want you to take care of Barzillai. I want you to take care of Yoav and Shimi in very different ways. And we saw that Shlomo took this very seriously. Hashem offered Shlomo the world back in chapter 3. And Shlomo's concern was, I want to make sure I live up to the expectations of this nation. I need to match my father. There's a lot going on here. God willing, we will start with that next week. But I think this is a very, very important sequence here, this dedication and the difference from the way David did it. So tune in next week. Next week, we will be back to having in-person at Shari Shamayim as well as the Zoom option. I hope to see as many of you as possible in person there. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, Dan.